Thank you very much, Hamilton. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Good afternoon. Judging from Melbourne time. It's great to follow Peter's observations. They're always pithy, to the point, and pungent. And I'll just pick up on 2 points you made, Peter. That issue about costs still being a big factor in our outlook, something which is very important, I think, in terms of this rush to stimulate the economy. We may have lost touch with some of those issues which are very important to everybody in this room and indeed everybody in the country. And secondly, your point about would a Labor government bail out New South Wales, I think probably there's probably two answers to that. One is the New South Wales government is beyond redemption. It's you know, I think it looks across the Tasman to see its future after the weekend. And secondly, a point to note that the leadership team does not contain anybody from New South Wales. There's a four-man leadership team, and I'm using the term non-gendered specifically when I say man. Two of them and the two brightest people in the room are from Victoria, so I'm pleased to say that. Who would expect it to get up here and have had Yeats quoted at them, followed by Dickens? I've heard some each-way bets, Peter, but that is the ultimate each-way bet, to use that quote from Dickens. So my topic today is the slow, slow burn turns hot, because probably the most important dynamic about all this is the time in which it's taken to unfold. It started with an unemployed car worker in Detroit, and we're going to end up with the Depression Mark II. I'm just exaggerating. I hope. We certainly started out with the unemployed car worker, which is the so-called ninjas. Loans, housing loans made to people with no income, no job or assets. And I think when it started out, very clearly the perception was it's something that's happening over there. And I use that term in two senses. One, over there, literally, geographically, it was something happening in America. So surely, I don't think anybody in this room back in the early part of 2007 would have been thinking about the impact that dodgy loans in the US could have on their lives, not just in the short term, but probably into the medium term. But also over there, this is very, very important in the way that the whole crisis unfolded in slow motion. When I look back over the last 18 months, it's not like looking at a car wreck happening in slow motion, a car crash happening in slow motion, but the Titanic hitting the iceberg in slow motion, in ultra slow motion. It's taken 18 months to really reach a point at which people actually think it's a serious issue that's going to impact on all our lives for some time yet. And now, of course, it is a problem everywhere. The overriding characteristic, I think, when I look back over the last 2 years is, I could come up with clichés as well as the previous speaker, the future is unpredictable. Literally, you cannot predict the future. Anybody that pretends to get up and predict the future should just have a look at the Treasury forecasting on the budget each year. And remains so. And it remains so as we speak today, that it is impossible to predict how this is all going to pan out, even in a one-year time frame, far less a 10-year time frame. But when you look back at the last 18 months, it's pretty obvious to see how event A led to event B, led to event C. You can trust the experts, though. I'm sure you can take comfort in that. I went back and did a search on our files on when the words subprime and crisis first started appearing in Australian newspapers. It was in March 2007. And interestingly, they appeared in the News Limited papers before they did in the Fairfax papers. So I give you that as the first reference I can find is in the Australian. And there is this quote, which I'm sure if you'd seen it or read it or absorbed it in March 2007, you'd be very relaxed. You'd be completely confident that this was a problem that was going to be isolated simply to the US, a particular part of the US banking and financial system, and would not far less have an impact on our general lives, would have very little impact on the financial system. And who did it come from? Interestingly, Tom Geithner, who is the hotshot head of the US New York Fed and a possible Obama Treasury Secretary, or certainly somebody that's going to play a prominent role in the coming administration in some form, even if he just stays at the New York Fed, which is the which is the funnel for all the activity that takes place in relation to the way the US government and the US Federal Reserve, which is in Washington, deals with the problem. So back in March 2007, there was no real sense of what was coming. And I put this graphic on the board to show you how even in November 07, more than 8 months later, the world still didn't have any sense of what was going to unfold in 2008. Remember, March 2007, the subprime loans start to go bad. But in November 07, the Dow Jones was just shy of its all-time peak, which is around 14,700. Our market actually hit that peak. In retrospect, John Howard and Peter Costello would have preferred the mix to be somewhat different. Rather than have the share market hit a peak and the Reserve Bank, as you'll remember, putting up interest rates on Cup Day last year, they would have probably preferred a slightly different mix. The gold price was 800. The oil price was 95. The reason why that is interesting is the oil price was at an extraordinarily high level. Nobody anticipated the oil price being that high. I can remember people talking in mid-07 about how do we live with $70 oil. That reflected the booming global economy, the oil price that high. And the gold price, high but not extraordinarily high, reflected no real sense of impending financial doom, because when there's an impending financial doom, people tend to flock into gold as a last resort, as a safe haven. As you can see, by July 08, the gold price was nearly $1,000. And our currency was heading towards parity, and as I said, the Reserve Bank was putting up interest rates. Even by July 08, when the financial markets had been hit, the Dow and our market were both down, you still had this underlying economic robustness with the oil price at nearly $140, which, yes, did reflect some financial speculation, but it also reflected this perception that the world economy was booming, led by China. And, of course, the Reserve Bank had put interest rates up to 7.25%, and in May of that year was still contemplating raising them further. So 2 points I'm making there. In November 07, there was no real sense that the financial crisis, that there was even a financial crisis, that there was a subprime issue, but that was something that could be handled and dealt with. And even in July 08, there was still no sense of this really impacting on the real economy. But then you look at the figures now, where you see obviously both the financial impacts are flowing through, both the US market and our market have been whacked, our currency has been whacked, and the Reserve Bank is cutting interest rates as quickly as it can. So there were 6 stages in this crisis. Initially, it was localised bad debts. Some banks had been more imprudent than others. Some merchant banks, investment banks, have been more imprudent than others. And it was all about the private sector replenishing capital. If we go back to those early months of 07, you could see the Merrill Lynches of this world tapping sovereign credit, sovereign investment agencies and major financial institutions to replenish their capital base, because it was just about replenishing capital. Second stage, we had individual liquidity problems across the financial system, and the response of the central banks, our Reserve Bank, the US Fed, the Bank of England and so on, was to open the discount window just a bit, very cautiously. We didn't want to be too profligate by taking in undesirable securities. And then gradually, as we went through 08, they opened it a little bit wider. But again, it was simply thought in terms of there was a liquidity issue in the financial system. You had to replenish the liquidity within the financial system. And then we moved to individual corporate bailouts, most notably in the US, Bear Stearns and AIG, and quote-unquote suggested mergers, where you bury the problem. This is the time-honoured way of dealing with a financial problem within an individual financial institution. You bury it in a bigger financial institution. So those 3 steps, which were unfolding as we went through 08, again, all about gradually not anticipating a slightly bigger problem, but no sense of the total cosmic nature of what was happening. Then we see that there's some beginning to understand that there's a systemic liquidity problem. Credit is not flowing through flowing through the financial systems, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere. And the Fed really threw open its doors and slashed interest rates to 1%, which Alan Greenspan did after 2001, and which is really the heart of the problem we face today. You reduce the official rate to 1%, you unleash all sorts of inappropriate extravagant, promiscuous financial behaviour. And one of the messages I would leave you with today is that we're in for a replay of that when we finally get out of this financial crisis slash economic recession, that we will pay a price for this profligacy in letting interest rates go that low. Everything changed, I hope you can read it, in mid-September when the Federal Reserve and the administration got hairy-chested and said, we're not about bailing out private companies and we'll let Lehman Brothers collapse. That was the point at which it flipped everything. It flipped everything in terms of the actual dynamics on the ground in financial markets around the world, where for the first time you got a real sense of counterparty risk, that maybe you get a cheque from Westpac, maybe you get a cheque from Citibank. I shouldn't have said Westpac. Not an Australian bank, not just because of the people in this room, but because the Australian banks were never in doubt. Maybe you get a cheque from Citibank and you mightn't be able to cash it. More realistically, if you lend a Citibank $100 million or $1 billion, you may be at some risk of not getting repaid in a year or 2 years or 3 years. And that flows right back to the overnight market, to the daily exchanges that require banks to have confidence in each other to settle their accounts. Although, ironically, as a consequence of letting Lehman go, there was no problem, no immediate problem. All the counterparty risks were settled, and they were settled quite reasonably. The system worked. It didn't implode. But it did raise this question that, can you trust the financial system? And it led directly to this systemic bailout, which was the $700 billion rescue package, and which probably helped cost John McCain the election, although other things probably cost him as well, and we'll hear from that in due course. But suddenly there's a systemic financial problem and a slightly growing awareness that maybe this is something that's going to spread beyond the financial system. So we lead to choices and consequences. The big question was, do we go the Iceland route or do we go the Ireland route? Who would ever have imagined that these two little countries, whose names begin with I, and I think we know the difference, one's green, one's white, could be at the real centre of this unfolding dynamic and would set the pattern for what would follow around the world. You know, Kevin Rudd's bank rescue package flows directly from this experience, that Iceland's financial system basically went broke. Even if it was guaranteed by the country, they couldn't do so because Iceland had set itself up as a mini Wall Street to channel financial flows around the world through the Iceland banks and on into the wonderful world of financial activity. And Ireland chose to, as we now know, guarantee its bank deposits in their entirety. Both of these actions led to all sorts of problems in the UK. Iceland, because UK depositors were depositing their money in Iceland banks. It's probably a lesson that Kevin Rudd learnt too closely. The prospect that Australian depositors would take their money out of Australian banks and put them in Irish banks, I don't think was ever really in great prospect. At the other extreme, Ireland guaranteeing its deposits when the English banks weren't guaranteed created a potential for that huge flow of money across the Irish Channel. So what won out? Everyone chose Bono over Bjork at the end of the day. So everybody then followed the Irish example. We took it a little stage too far. Plus we had Kevin Rudd channeling Winston Churchill. And now we've got to a situation, I'll explain that in a second, we've got, and I'm not talking about Barack Obama's comment on the weekend, migration of the problem from the financial to the real economy. Clearly the G7 is in and is going to stay in recession. China is clearly slowing. We've got a huge stimulus package announced in China on Sunday. And Australia, question mark, but we are clearly slowing. I want to take a step back for a minute and go back to what was happening, unfolding through 2008. The Masters of Martin Place met the less than Masters of the Universe in the middle of 2008. The Reserve Bank started the year deliberately setting out to slow the economy while Wall Street set about destroying it. Now, I think they both succeeded in their own way. But the Wall Street one was very much in the foreground. But don't lose sight of the fact that where we are today in the real economy is precisely where the Reserve Bank wanted us to be. And I think when you look back at 2008, it was pretty skillful in balancing the two, in dealing with the financial crisis while persisting in its efforts to slow the economy. And that was his High Wire Act. Glenn Stevens' High Wire Act. I won't go into the detail of that, but you can get my presentation later if you wish to absorb it. But essentially, Australian banks had limited exposures to the financial crisis, so there was no sense of this was something that would really directly impact on us immediately. It was essentially a North Atlantic problem. And we still had high inflation, and until recently a strong economy. But the Reserve Bank has now pirouetted 180 degrees. After thinking about hiking in May, it's now clearly in slash mode, and we saw that in the last with the last two meetings. Kevin Rudd's 10-10 date with destiny. Now, I'm not giving you a perfect score, but dating his transformational moment. 10-10, the 10th of October, which led to that spectacular weekend. There were a complex of drivers in the way I think he reacted. I think he looked into the abyss and saw this huge problem that would destroy not only his prime ministership, but indeed would seriously damage Australia, and he saw the opportunity to be decisive. It also played directly to his bureaucratic strengths. There was a problem, he could now seek to manage it. And that's the process by which he moved from being somebody that was completely agnostic about what was happening in the financial sector to somebody that actually appreciated that it was a major problem that was going to impact on Australia directly. We actually had him in the office on the Wednesday before that weekend, and he was talking about this rolling financial national security crisis. It was also accompanied by an extraordinarily arrogant performance from him. He had his feet on the editor's coffee table, his big R.M. Williams boots, and so the arrogance probably made us not fully appreciate how seriously he was seeing the problem, but he really saw it as his Churchillian moment, his Dunkirk, where he had to seize the reins, he had to do these dramatic changes to save the financial system, A, with the bank guarantee, and then the credit, then the $10 billion package. Point is, it literally came from nowhere without advice after that Friday when the share market tanked, after Wall Street had tanked. And the advice has sort of come later. I mean, in a very narrow sense, obviously, it was Treasury did the numbers, but there was no sense of a really considered policy change. And so now we've got a huge boost of stimulus to the economy, the Reserve Bank cutting rates, the spending package, and that drop in the value of the Aussie. All of that hugely stimulatory to the economy. You've got a whole complex of overlays when you look at 2009 coming up. We're still playing out the impact of those RBA high rates. You've got this very aggressive stimulus. You've got the global meltdown. All of those things are going to unfold and interact as we go into 2009. Why is it important to us? Very simply, this graph captures it. There's far more linkages as a consequence of the global meltdown, but the banking system is now hooked. Our Australian banking system is now hooked on funding from the international markets. In a way, it was never the case before. Back in the 1990s, back in the 1990 recession, its liability base was all local, and it was mostly deposits from ordinary citizens. Now you see that. $440 billion is non-resident funding, and a large chunk of the resident borrowing is also from exotic forms of securitisation. This is just to show you the impact of the financial crisis as it was unfolding. It destroyed the mortgage-backed security market. This is the US numbers that they were running at $100 billion a month. Through 2007 down to $20 billion a month now, and it's only agencies, that's official government agencies, able to borrow by mortgage securities. And this is the Australian example, same thing, they're running at $25 billion a month, they were down to barely $5 billion a month mid-08. This is the interest rate impact, the way that credit margins have risen dramatically and have stayed high. Robert's probably going to talk about it, so I won't spend any time on it. But that's the cost of money, the real cost of money over and above the cash rate, which is that direct consequence of people being worried about the security of their, and there's another graph on that front, whether you could actually trust putting your money in a bank. I have to tell you, it's going to get worse in America. This is the history of the mortgage delinquencies and foreclosures. You can see the yellow line of the US example. This is all the US example. That's subprime and that's prime. And this is why it's going to get worse. This tells you how these things worsen from the initial date. These are the subprime delinquencies by vintage. You can see the 2006 ones are up to 27%. The 2007 ones are only up to 15%. And this is before the economic downturn, before the recession in the United States. So the delinquencies in the US are only going to get worse. Why I say 700 billion shbillion. It's not going to touch the sides in dealing with the issue. So, complex of forces for 2009. All of these things are going to play out. China booming question mark. New South Wales is in recession. Our biggest state with 33% of the population, 33% of the economy is in recession. The global financial meltdown, the panic rescues. You have no sense in any of this that they actually know what they're doing. The $700 billion started out as a proposal to buy toxic assets. It was always clear from the start it should have been mainly about recapitalising financial institutions. Finally, they decide, OK, we'll put $250 billion through forced nationalisation of all the major financial institutions in the US. Is anybody in charge of the madhouse? You have to ask yourself. So the panic rescues are in themselves a worry about how this is going to play out and the broader policy shift and the recession. And as I say, too much of this, does anybody have any sense that it's going to work? I certainly don't have any confidence in that. That's the confidence graphs, and they've deteriorated since then. Consumer prices, inflation is supposed to be yesterday's problem. I'm not so sure. And there's the impact on most of us, which is superannuation takes a hit and is going to take another hit. These are the forecasts, the way they've come down from the budget. In May, the Reserve Bank put out its forecast this morning. I haven't got them in the graph. Rob is probably going to talk about it. It's below 2% now. And is that believable? I don't know. Growth is going to be lower than forecast. Inflation is going to be higher. I won't stay there. That just shows you how it all depends for us on our, not the G7, which is going to go in recession, but the non-G7, which is principally China. And that's the question with China. You can see how China is not, these are China's exports, and they've gone to zero in terms of growth, import volumes from China, which is exports from China to the major countries. They've gone to zero, so China's no longer getting the boost from selling into the developed world, and GDP has come down below 10%. And that's obviously fundamental to our future. I'll pass over that one, and that's the bottom line. We looked forward to a world in which economic growth was going to be strong and stable with a rising trend, thanks to China. Now that's under huge question mark in the short to medium term. So on that optimistic note, I'll thank you very much. Much appreciated, and I'll pass back to Hamilton.